One afternoon when the sun was going down, a mother and her little boy sat at the door of their cottage, talking about the great stone face. They had but to lift their eyes, and there it was, plainly to be seen, though miles away, with the sunshine brightening all its features. And what was the great stone face? Embosomed amongst a family of lofty mountains, there was a valley so spacious that it contained many thousand inhabitants. Some of these good people dwelt in log huts with the black forest all around them. Others had their homes in comfortable farmhouses and cultivated the rich soil on the gentle slopes. Others again were congregated into populous villages, but all of them, grown people and children, had a kind of familiarity with the great stone face. The great stone face, then, was a work of nature and her mood of majestic playfulness, formed on the perpendicular side of a mountain by some immense rocks, which had been thrown together in such a position as, when viewed at a proper distance, precisely to resemble the features of the human countenance. It seemed as if an enormous giant, or a titan, had sculptured his own likeness on the precipice. There was the broad arch of the forehead, 100 feet in height, the nose with its long bridge, and the vast lips, which, if they could have spoken, would have rolled their thunder accents from one end of the valley to the other. True it is that if the spectator approached too near, he lost the outline of the gigantic visage, and could discern only a heap of ponderous and gigantic rocks piled in chaotic ruin one upon another. Retracing his steps, however, the wondrous features would again be seen, and the farther he withdrew from them, the more like a human face with all its original divinity intact did they appear, until, as it grew dim in the distance, with the clouds and glorified vapor of the mountains clustering about it, the great stone face seemed positively to be alive. It was a happy lot for children to grow up to manhood or womanhood with the great stone face before their eyes, for all the features were noble and the expression was at once grand and sweet, as if it were the glow of a vast, warm heart that embraced all mankind in its affections and had room for more. According to the belief of many people, the valley owed much of its fertility to this benign aspect that was continually beaming over it, illuminating the clouds and infusing its tenderness into the sunshine. As we began with saying, a mother and her little boy sat at their cottage door, gazing at the great stone face and talking about it. The child's name was Ernest. "Mother," said he, while the titanic visage smiled on him, "I wish that it could speak, for it looks so very kindly that its voice must need be pleasant. If I were to see a man with such a face, I should love him dearly." "If an old prophecy should come to pass," answered his mother, "we may see a man some time or other with exactly such a face as that." "What prophecy do you mean, dear mother?" eagerly inquired Ernest. "Pray tell me all about it." So his mother told him a story that her own mother had told to her when she herself was younger than little Ernest. A story so very old that even the Indians who formerly inhabited this valley had heard it from their forefathers, to whom, as they affirmed, it had been murmured by the mountain streams and whispered by the wind among the treetops. The purport was that at some future day a child should be born hereabouts who was destined to become the greatest and noblest personage of his time, and whose countenance in manhood should bear an exact resemblance to the great stone face. "Oh, mother, dear mother," cried Ernest, "I do hope that I shall live to see him." His mother was an affectionate and thoughtful woman, and felt that it was wisest not to discourage the generous hopes of her little boy, so she only said to him, "Perhaps you may." And Ernest never forgot the story that his mother told him. It was always in his mind whenever he looked upon the great stone face. He spent his childhood in the log cottage where he was born, and was dutiful to his mother, and helpful to her in many things. Yet Ernest had had no teacher, save only that the great stone face became one to him. When the toil of the day was over, he would gaze at it for hours, until he began to imagine that those vast features recognized him, and gave him a smile of kindness and encouragement, responsive to his own look of veneration. We must not take upon us to affirm that this was a mistake, although the face may have looked no more kindly at Ernest than at all the world besides. But the secret was that the boy's tender and confiding simplicity discerned what other people could not see, and thus the love which was meant for all became his peculiar portion. About this time, there went a rumor throughout the valley that the great man foretold from ages long ago, who was to bear a resemblance to the great stone face, had appeared at last. It seems that many years before, a young man had migrated from the valley and settled at a distant seaport. His name, but I could never learn whether it was his real one or a nickname that had grown out of his habits and success in life, was Gathergold. Being shrewd and active and endowed by Providence with that inscrutable faculty which develops itself in what the world calls luck, he became an exceedingly rich merchant and owner of a whole fleet of bulky-bottomed ships. All the countries of the globe appeared to join hands for the mere purpose of adding heap after heap to the mountainous accumulation of this one man's wealth. And when Mr. Gathergold had become so very rich that it would have taken him 100 years only to count his wealth, he bethought himself of his native valley and resolved to go back thither and end his days where he was born. As I have said, it had already been rumored in the valley that Mr. Gathergold had turned out to be the prophetic personage so long and vainly looked for, and that his visage was the perfect and undeniable similitude of the great stone face. People were the more ready to believe that this must needs be the fact when they beheld the splendid edifice that rose, as if by enchantment, on the site of his father's old weather-beaten farmhouse. The exterior was of marble, so dazzlingly white that it seemed as though the whole structure might melt away in the sunshine. Hardly anybody had been permitted to see the interior of this palace. But it was reported, and with good semblance of truth, to be far more gorgeous than the outside. Our friend Ernest, meanwhile, had been deeply stirred by the idea that the great man, the noble man, the man of prophecy, after so many ages of delay, was at length to be made manifest to his native valley. And one evening, while the boy was still gazing up the valley and fancying, as he always did, that the great stone face returned his gaze and looked kindly at him, the rumbling of wheels was heard, approaching swiftly along the winding road. "Here he comes," cried a group of people who were assembled to witness the arrival. "Here comes the great Mr. Gathergold." A carriage, drawn by 4 horses, dashed around the turn of the road. Within it, thrust partly out of the window, appeared the physiognomy of the old man, with a skin as yellow as if his own Midas hand had transmuted it. He had a low forehead, small, sharp eyes, puckered about with innumerable wrinkles, and very thin lips, which he made still thinner by pressing them forcibly together. "The very image of the great stone face," shouted the people. "Sure enough, the old prophecy is true, and here we have the great man come at last. He is the very image of the great stone face." But Ernest turned sadly from the wrinkled shrewdness of that sordid visage and gazed up the valley, where amid a gathering mist, gilded by the last sunbeams, he could still distinguish those glorious features which had impressed themselves into his soul. Their aspect cheered him. What did the benign lips seem to say? "He will come. Fear not, Ernest. The man will come." The years went on, and Ernest ceased to be a boy. He had grown to be a young man now. He attracted little notice from the other inhabitants of the valley, for they saw nothing remarkable in his way of life, save that when the labor of the day was over, he still loved to go apart and gaze and meditate upon the great stone face. By this time, poor Mr. Gathergold was dead and buried. And the oddest part of the matter was that his wealth, which was the body and spirit of his existence, had disappeared before his death, leaving nothing of him but a living skeleton covered over with a wrinkled yellow skin. So the people ceased to honor him during his lifetime and quietly consigned him to forgetfulness after his decease. Thus the man of prophecy was yet to come. It so happened that a native-born son of the valley, many years before, had enlisted as a soldier, and after a great deal of hard fighting had now become an illustrious commander. Whatever he may be called in history, he was known in camps and on the battlefield under the nickname of Old Blood and Thunder, this war-worn veteran being now infirm with age and wounds and weary of the turmoil of a military life, had lately signified a purpose of returning to his native valley. The inhabitants were resolved to welcome the renowned warrior with a salute of cannon and a public dinner, and all the more enthusiastically at being affirmed that now, at last, the likeness of the great stone face had actually appeared. An aide-de-camp of Old Blood and Thunder, travelling through the valley, was said to have been struck with the resemblance. Moreover, the schoolmates and early acquaintances of the general were ready to testify on oath that, to the best of their recollection, the aforesaid general had been exceedingly like the majestic image, even when a boy, only that the idea had never occurred to them at that period. On the day of the great festival, Ernest, with all the other people of the valley, left their work and proceeded to the spot where the sylvan banquet was prepared. Over the general's chair, which was a relic from the home of Washington, there was an arch of verdant boughs with a laurel profusely intermixed, and surmounted by his country's banner, beneath which he had won his victories. Our friend Ernest raised himself on his tiptoes in hopes to get a glimpse of the celebrated guest. But there was a mighty crowd about the tables, anxious to hear the toasts and speeches, and to catch any word that might fall from the general in reply. Meantime, however, he could overhear the remarks of various individuals who were comparing the features of the hero with the face on the distant mountainside. "'Tis the same face to a hair," cried one man, cutting a caper for joy. "Wonderfully like, that's a fact," responded another. "Like? Why, I call it Old Blood and Thunder himself, in a monstrous looking-glass," cried a third. "The general! The general!" was now the cry. "Hush! Silence! Old Blood and Thunder's going to make a speech." Even so. For the cloth being removed, the general's health had been drunk amid shouts of applause, and he now stood upon his feet to thank the company. Ernest saw him. There he was, over the shoulders of the crowd. And there, too, visible in the same glance, through the vista of the forest, appeared the great stone face. And was there, indeed, such a resemblance as the crowd had testified? Alas, Ernest could not recognize it. He beheld a war-worn and weather-beaten countenance full of energy and expressive of an iron will, but the gentle wisdom, the deep, broad, tender sympathies were altogether wanting in Old Blood and Thunder's visage, and even if the great stone face had assumed his look of stern command, the milder traits would still have tempered it. "This is not the man of prophecy," sighed Ernest to himself, as he made his way out of the throng. "Must the world wait longer yet?" But as it always did, the aspect of his marvelous friend made Ernest as hopeful as if he had never hoped in vain. More years sped swiftly and tranquilly away. Ernest still dwelt in his native valley and was now a man of middle age. By imperceptible degrees, he had become known among the people. Now, as heretofore, he labored for his bread and was the same simple-hearted man he had always been. But he had thought and felt so much, he had given so many of the best hours of his life to unworldly hopes for some great good to mankind, that it seemed as though he had been talking with the angels and had imbibed a portion of their wisdom unawares. Almost involuntarily, too, he had become a preacher. He uttered truths that wrought upon and moulded the lives of those who heard him. His auditors, it may be, never suspected that Ernest, their own neighbour and familiar friend, was more than an ordinary man. Least of all did Ernest himself suspect it. But inevitably, as the murmur of a rivulet, came thoughts out of his mouth that no other human lips had spoken. When the people's minds had had a little time to cool, they were ready enough to acknowledge their mistake in imagining a similarity between General Blood and Thunder's truculent physiognomy and the benign visage on the mountainside. But now again, there were reports and many paragraphs in the newspapers affirming that the likeness of the great stone face had appeared upon the broad shoulders of a certain eminent statesman. He, like Mr. Gathergold and old Blood and Thunder, was a native of the valley, but had left it in his early days and taken up the trades of law and politics. Instead of the rich man's wealth and the warrior's sword, he had but a tongue, and it was mightier than both together. When it pleased him, he could make a kind of illuminated fog with his mere breath and obscure the natural daylight with it. His tongue, indeed, was a magic instrument. Sometimes it rumbled like the thunder. Sometimes it warbled like the sweetest music. It was the blast of war, the song of peace, and it seemed to have a heart in it, when there was no such matter. His admirers had found out the resemblance between him and the great stone face, and so much were they struck by it that throughout the country this distinguished gentleman was known by the name of Old Stony Phiz. The phrase was considered as giving a highly favorable aspect to his political prospects. While his friends were doing their best to make him president, Old Stony Phiz, as he was called, set out on a visit to the valley where he was born. Magnificent preparations were made to receive the illustrious statesman, a cavalcade of horsemen set forth to meet him at the boundary line of the state, and all the people left their business and gathered along the wayside to see him pass. Among these was Ernest. Though more than once disappointed, as we have seen, he kept his heart continually open and thus was sure to catch the blessing from on high when it should come. So now again, as buoyantly as ever, he went forth to behold the likeness of the great stone face. The cavalcade came prancing along the road with a great clattering of hooves and a mighty cloud of dust, which rose up so dense and high that the visage of the mountainside was completely hidden from Ernest's eyes. It really was a very brilliant spectacle, especially as there were numerous banners flaunting over the cavalcade, and some of which were gorgeous portraits of the illustrious statesman and the great stone face, smiling familiarly at one another like two brothers. We must not forget to mention that there was a band of music which made the echoes of the mountains ring and reverberate with the loud triumph of its strains. But the grandest effect was when the far-off mountain precipice flung back the music, for then the great stone face itself seemed to be swelling the triumphant chorus in acknowledgement that, at length, the man of prophecy was come. All this while the people were throwing up their hats and shouting with enthusiasm so contagious that the heart of Ernest kindled up, and he likewise threw up his hat and shouted as loudly as the loudest, "Huzzah for the great man! Huzzah for old Stony Phiz!" But as yet he had not seen him. "Here he is now," cried those who stood near Ernest. "There, there! Look at old Stony Phiz, and then at the old man of the mountain, and see if they are not as like as two twin brothers." In the midst of all this gallant array came an open barouche, drawn by four white horses, and in the barouche, with his massive head uncovered, sat the illustrious statesman, old Stony Phiz himself. "Confess it," said one of Ernest's neighbors to him, "the great stone face has met its match at last." Now it must be owned that at his first glimpse of the countenance which was bowing and smiling from the barouche, Ernest did fancy that there was a resemblance between it and the old familiar face upon the mountainside. The brow, with its massive depth and loftiness, and all the other features indeed, were boldly and strongly hewn, as if in emulation of a more than heroic, of a titanic model. But the sublimity and stateliness the grand expression of a divine sympathy that illuminated the mountain visage and etherealized its ponderous granite substance into spirit might here be sought in vain. Something had been originally left out, or had departed. The marvelously gifted statesman had always a weary gloom in the deep caverns of his eyes, as of a child that has outgrown its playthings, or a man of mighty faculties and little aims, whose life, with all its high performances, was vague and empty, because no high purpose had endowed it with reality. Ernest turned away melancholy and almost despondent. For this was the saddest of his disappointments, to behold a man who might have fulfilled the prophecy and had not willed to do so. Meantime, the cavalcade, the banners, the music, and the barouches swept past him, with a vociferous crowd in the rear, leaving the dust to settle down, and the great stone face to be revealed again with a grandeur that it had worn for untold centuries. "Lo, here I am, Ernest," the benign lips seemed to say. "I have waited longer than thou, and am not yet weary. Fear not, the man will come." The years hurried onward, treading in their haste on one another's heels, and now they began to bring white hairs and scam over the head of Ernest. They made reverent wrinkles across his forehead and furrows in his cheeks. He was an aged man. But not in vain had he grown old, more than the white hairs on his head were the sage thoughts in his mind. His wrinkles and furrows were inscriptions that time had graved, and in which he had written legends of wisdom that had been tested by the tenor of a life. And Ernest had ceased to be obscure. Unsought for, undesired, had come the fame which so many seek, and made him known in the great world beyond the limits of the valley in which he had dwelt so quietly. While Ernest had been growing up and growing old, a bountiful providence had granted a new poet to this earth. He likewise was a native of the valley, but had spent the greater part of his life at a distance from that romantic region, pouring out his sweet music amid the bustle and din of cities. The songs of this poet found their way to Ernest. He read them after his customary toil, seated on the bench before his cottage door, where for such a length of time he had filled his repose with thought by gazing at the great stone face. And now as he read stanzas that caused the soul to thrill within him, he lifted his eyes to the vast countenance beaming on him so benignantly. "O majestic friend," he murmured, addressing the great stone face, "is not this man worthy to resemble thee?" The face seemed to smile, but answered not a word. Now it happened that the poet, though he dwelt so far away, had not only heard of Ernest, but had meditated much upon his character until he deemed nothing so desirable as to meet this man, whose untaught wisdom walked hand in hand with the noble simplicity of his life. One summer morning, therefore, he took passage by the railroad, and in the decline of the afternoon alighted from the cars at no great distance from Ernest's cottage. The great hotel, which had formerly been the palace of Mr. Gathergold, was close at hand, but the poet, with his carpet bag on his arm, inquired at once where Ernest dwelt, and was resolved to be accepted as his guest. Approaching the door, he there found the good old man holding a volume in his hand, which alternately he read, and then, with a finger between the leaves, looked lovingly at the great stone face. "Good evening," said the poet. "Can you give a traveller a night's lodging?" "Willingly," answered Ernest, and then he added, smiling, "Methinks I never saw the great stone face look so hospitably at a stranger." The poet sat down on the bench beside him, and he and Ernest talked together. Often had the poet held intercourse with the wittiest and the wisest, but never before with a man like Ernest, whose thoughts and feelings gushed up with such a natural freedom, and who made great truths so familiar by his simple utterance of them. and Ernest, on the other hand, was moved and agitated by the living images which the poet flung out of his mind and which peopled all the air about the cottage door with shapes of beauty, both gay and pensive. The sympathies of these two men instructed them with a profounder sense than either could have attained alone. Their minds accorded into one strain and made delightful music which neither of them could have claimed as all his own, nor distinguished his own share from the others. They led one another, as it were, into a high pavilion of their thoughts, so remote and hitherto so dim that they had never entered it before, and so beautiful that they desired to be there always. As Ernest listened to the poet, he imagined that the great stone face was bending forward to listen too. He gazed earnestly into the poet's glowing eyes. "Who are you, my strangely gifted guest?" he said. The poet laid his finger on the volume that Ernest had been reading. "You have read these poems," said he. "You know me then, for I wrote them." Again, and still more earnestly than before, Ernest examined the poet's features, then turned towards the great stone face, then back, with an uncertain aspect to his guest, that his countenance fell. He shook his head and sighed. "Wherefore are you sad?" inquired the poet. "Because," replied Ernest, "all through life I have awaited the fulfillment of a prophecy, and when I read these poems, I hoped that it might be fulfilled in you." "You hoped," answered the poet, faintly smiling, "to find in me the likeness of the great stone face. And you are disappointed, as formerly, with Mr. Gathergold and old Blood and Thunder and old Stony Fizz. Yes, Ernest, you must add my name to the illustrious three and record another failure of your hopes. For in shame and sadness do I speak it, Ernest. I am not worthy to be typified by yonder benign and majestic image." "And why?" asked Ernest. He pointed to the volume. "Are not those thoughts divine?" "They have a strain of the divinity," replied the poet. "You can hear in them the far-off echo of a heavenly song. But my life, dear Ernest, has not corresponded with my thought. I have had grand dreams, but they have been only dreams, because I have lived, and that too by my own choice, among poor and mean realities." The poet spoke sadly, and his eyes were dim with tears, so likewise were those of Ernest. At the hour of sunset, as had long been his frequent custom, Ernest was to discourse to an assemblage of the neighboring inhabitants in the open air. He and the poet, arm in arm, still talking together as they went along, proceeded to the spot. At a small elevation above the ground, set in a rich framework of verdure, there appeared a niche spacious enough to admit a human figure. Into this natural pulpit Ernest ascended, and threw a look of familiar kindness around upon his audience. They stood, or sat, or reclined upon the grass, as seemed good to each, with the departing sunshine falling obliquely over them, and mingling its subdued cheerfulness with the solemnity of a grove of ancient trees. Ernest began to speak, giving to the people of what was in his heart and mind. His words had power because they accorded with his thoughts, and his thoughts had reality and depth because they harmonized with the life which he had always lived. The poet, as he listened, felt that the being and character of Ernest were a nobler strain of poetry than he had ever written. His eyes glistening with tears, he gazed reverentially at the venerable man and said within himself that never was there an aspect so worthy of a prophet and a sage as that mild, sweet, thoughtful countenance with a glory of white hair diffused about it. At a distance, but distinctly to be seen, high up in the golden light of the setting sun, appeared the great stone face with hoary mists around it, like the white hairs around the brow of Ernest. Its look of grand beneficence seemed to embrace the world. At that moment, in sympathy with a thought which he was about to utter, the face of Ernest assumed a grandeur of expression so imbued with benevolence that the poet, by an irresistible impulse, threw his arms aloft and shouted, "Behold, behold, Ernest is himself the likeness of the great stone face." Then all the people looked and saw that what the deep-sighted poet said was true. The prophecy was fulfilled. But Ernest, having finished what he had to say, took the poet's arm and walked slowly homeward, still hoping that some wiser and better man than himself would by and by appear, bearing a resemblance to the great stone face.